I watched my own classmates get married to father, and I wondered why it was so young and how would I get to marry somebody anywhere near my age if he was marrying the girls off so young, because that's really what started to happen there.
Welcome back, everyone. My name is Sam.
And I'm Melissa.
I grew up in the FLDS community. It is a polygamous group run by Warren Jeffs, and I moved out when I was 18 years old.
I was raised LDS. Sam and I have been married for 9 years and have two awesome kiddos.
Yes, we do. We want to quickly thank our donors, YouTube members, and our patrons. We really do appreciate your love and support.
Yes, today we are so excited to have such a special interview with someone who just has so many details. And the first time that they reached out to us, I was just like, oh my gosh, this is amazing to have so much information, such a wealth of knowledge as far as the workings of Warren Jeffs and his family. So
thank you, Ammon Jeffs, for being here with us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Of course, we're excited to have one of Warren Jeffs' sons with us today that has a lot of information about, well, Warren Jeffs and his family, and a lot of information about the Texas raid that happened there in El Dorado or El Dorado, Texas. And he actually just finished writing a book about his whole experience. So we're just going to get a sneak peek in the interview here of what's going to be in that book. And after that, you're all welcome to go and purchase it. Where can people find that book, just so that we can let people know here, Ammon?
That book will be, or it already is, on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, Ingram Spark. It'll be on the other book websites that are really common, but those are the three main places where we have it published right now.
Awesome. I'll definitely leave a link to Amazon then below so that people can go. And the name of it is Texas Raid, correct?
Correct.
Okay, awesome. So, Ammon, I told you where we were going to start, and then now I'm like already thinking of other questions. But I guess before we get into kind of your history, what made you decide that you wanted to write a book?
When the raid happened and CPS took everyone under 18 years old that was a child, I was the oldest male child that was removed from the ranch. And had a lot of responsibility through the raid, experienced a lot of different facets of the raid. And my father told everyone that was part of the raid to make a record of what our enemies did to us. That's his words. I think he based that out of one of the sections in the Doctrine and Covenants. I couldn't remember exactly which one, but that was the basis for having everyone write their story. Now, I wanted to keep a record of what happened because it was a huge thing in my life at the time and a huge growing up experience. So I started writing it in 2008 and finished the base of my story in 2013, kind of put it on the shelf for several years before I pulled it off again last May and dusted off the covers and got going on what is now my book, Texas Raid.
Wow. I can't imagine the experiences you must have gone through. I remember as a young boy growing up in the FLDS in Short Creek area, the fear of there being another raid because, you know, my father had talked about the raid that he dealt with when he was a little boy and the man put in prison and all of that. So I can only imagine what that experience must have been like for you. So, but before we get into your experience on the ranch and raid, can you just give us a quick backstory of who you are? Where you came from, where you were born and raised, kind of what your childhood was like.
Okay. I was born to Warren Jeffs and his second wife, Barbara Barlow. I was his 10th child, third son, and my mother's fourth child. I was born in Sandy, Utah, and when I was born, we only had two mothers. That changed pretty quick. But I grew up for 8 years in Sandy, Utah, before we moved to Short Creek. By the time I was 8 years old, we had eight mothers. But we had a lot of fun growing up. I remember hiking the mountains, playing with my family and cousins and the other people that were part of the FLES in Salt Lake area. Once in a while, we'd go down to Short Creek and visit, but that mostly was for the older kids, not us younger ones so much.
I see. What was it like being born into royalty within the FLDS Church? Was it a lot of pressure, or was it just all hunky-dory and a great life?
Well, we were definitely told we needed to be an example for the people, especially being grandchildren to Ruth and Jeff's. When I was born, Father was just an elder in the church, and that changed when I was 8, or just before I turned 8. When he was made the first counselor by his father.
Interesting.
Father always told us, you're representing me, but we were still boys.
Right. Well, that's good to hear, because some people have wondered, you know, as a child to Warren Jeffs, were you allowed to be a boy, you know, or just be a child and have fun and do things that kids like to do? Or was it mostly serious and this is how you have to act, you know, very properly, and you can't be like other people? So that's why I asked the question.
It really changed when he became the leader. Not so much before. I know, like when we built an addition on our house in Short Creek, then he would tell us, boys, everybody that works on my house tells me you boys are just like other boys, and kind of reprimanding us because we weren't being quite as obedient as we should be. But the pressure really turned up after he became the leader.
I see.
So how old were you when he did become the leader and prophet?
I was 12 years old when he became the leader.
I see. Well, I remember when that addition to the house was being done, I actually did some of the landscaping in the yard and helped build the big block wall around the home and all of that. And, you know, and it was just, I remember looking up to the Jeffs family and your father and Ruland Jeffs as a young boy as like these perfect people that could do no wrong. So I always wondered, as a child to these men, were you under the same impression, or did, because you saw more of them, was it obvious to you that they were just, or that they could make mistakes like every other man?
I thought Father was perfect. I thought Grandfather was perfect.
Okay.
I have had my older siblings say they didn't, but being a younger one, and he was way more responsible as I grew up than earlier years. So I thought he was perfect, and he acted like he was perfect.
At that point, you know, your memory, probably most of your childhood memory, was him preparing to be the next prophet in line. Or did that come suddenly? What, did you know that he was preparing to be a prophet, or did that come kind of unexpectedly?
Well, he always told us that my grandfather would be the last prophet, and he was going to suddenly be renewed and made young. So he never intimated anything that he would be the next prophet, but he also acted very, in public, he acted very formal and perfect to the people. And that's mostly what I saw. Now, I can remember him having fun with us, but I never saw something that I could have thought was wrong, because he didn't allow that kind of thinking in the family.
I see.
What did he tell you when your grandfather did pass away? Because I know that there's been different families kind of reacted to that differently. Some thinking that Warren was, you know, that like Ruland kind of had become Warren, or like was a part of him now, or different theories. But what did your father actually say when your grandfather passed away?
When it very first happened, he seemed quite stressed about what to do. And I remember him talking to us as a family within a week or two, saying, well, in the days of Joseph Smith, before he ordained apostles and first presidency, he was just a leading elder in the church. So that's what we have now. And that seemed to be kind of a relief for him. And it was about a month later when he suddenly started taking his father's wives as his wives. And that's when everything really seemed to change. But right after my grandfather died, we didn't automatically think he was a prophet. At least I didn't as a 12-year-old.
So in that month, what changed? Did it click in his brain that, oh, wow, these people will follow me and do what I say, and so therefore I'm going to do what I want? Like, what do you think happened in that month's time?
I often wonder if he thought the people couldn't survive unless he took the leadership, because his father was the last apostle in the church that anybody knew had actually been ordained like that. And he hadn't, but I didn't know, because I always wondered if he just thought the people wouldn't survive without him and someone else couldn't fulfill the place besides him. And that's very possibly how he started. And it just, his character, the evils he had already been doing, carried on. And that accountability he felt he had, at least to a degree, to his father and other men around him, went away.
Interesting. Wow. It's just so interesting to have someone that was in the inside, you know, and saw it kind of unfold, because we hear so many stories. And of course, I was living in the community of Short Creek, and so I kind of saw what was happening from the outside of the family. But most of what I knew and saw of your father and your grandfather was in church meetings. And so, you know, I was always, because we were taught at home that they were perfect and that they were men of God, we would go to these meetings and we would shake their hands at the end of the meeting. And I felt like that they were looking through my soul and that they knew everything about me. And, you know, and so I often wondered, wow, to live in the home, would it be less, if you want to call it magical, or would it be kind of the same thing, just more of it?
Once he took over the leadership, it was like that, where you thought maybe he could see your whole soul. I don't remember feeling that way before, but after he did, he seemed to change a lot and wasn't even with us as a family very often. He stopped going to a lot of the meetings, but he also stopped having as much to do with his own family.
I see.
And in our minds and the way he taught us, we had to earn him to come give us another training, or earn him to come to a meal. And even at the meal times, it just was a training usually, not as much activities and things like that.
Wow.
So at what point, or how old were you when the ranch started being built? And did you know right away, being part of Warren's family, like, did you know about the ranch as soon as it started? Or was it like a lot of the rest of the people in the community that it was all secretive for a long time and all of a sudden you just went?
He kept it really secret. And the thing I noticed as a 13-year-old was that he was gone. He wasn't just in his room now. We could tell he was being gone for long periods of time. And after a few months, family members started disappearing, but nobody ever knew where it was or what was going on. And he didn't tell us Zion started or anything like that.
Even within his own family. Wow. That's surprising. Wow.
How much of your family ended up at the ranch? So you said, you know, your mom had quite a few children, and at this point there's like more and more and more wives, right? About how many of his direct family ended up going to the ranch versus staying in Short Creek?
At first, only a few went. Then in November of 2003, he took all of his younger children. He left us older children, told our mothers to tell us that we weren't obedient enough to go to what he called Zion. And that's all we knew it as, was Zion. We didn't know where it was. We didn't know it was more than one place. But eventually he gathered almost his whole family to one of the places, and he called these places places of refuge. So we were gathered to these places, but not all in one house.
And you're referring to like there was the Texas ranch, and then there was places in Colorado, and I forget the other places, but are you referring to different states or just different places within the compound? Okay.
There's three states that he had places of refuge in. There was R1 in Colorado near Mancos. R17 was the ranch down in Texas near El Dorado. And R23 was in South Dakota near Pringle. And those are the names everybody that lived on them went by. That's what he called them. That's what we called them.
Interesting.
Did you know what the numbers were stood for?
I didn't ever hear a real definite reason why he called him what he did.
Yeah, instead of like 1, 2, and 3.
Wow.
1, 17 and 20-something.
I mean, if you want to make something sound like an experiment, call it by numbers. Oh my gosh.
Extra secretive because no one knows what that 2 through 16, who knows where those are?
Wow. I mean, I know some of what happened in these different places, and it just honestly makes me sick. But I'm more curious now about your experience. Did you know before you went to the ranch in Texas, did you know that your father was on the run from the FBI and law enforcement?
I did not. He told us that the enemies of the church, the government, was coming against the priesthood people, the FLDS, stronger and stronger, and were going to try to take his life. But he didn't tell us he was on the run, and he was very, very secretive.
Okay. So he didn't say, hey, they're going to try to put me in prison. He said, they're going to come try to take my life.
Yes.
Wow. Interesting. I haven't heard that either. I do remember when they first caught him in Las Vegas and everything started unraveling at that point. But I was shocked. And I'm curious to hear if you were as well. I was shocked that they finally caught him. I thought that God would protect him forever. Is that what you thought too?
Yes, absolutely. We thought God was with him, God was protecting him, and he had kept him hidden from the FBI and these people that were seeking his life this long, and we figured that would continue to happen.
So when they did catch him then, because of the way he phrased that, did you expect his life to be over now that they caught him? They were just going to kill him?
He never said they would if they caught him, and he always promised that somehow the Lord would bring him through. So his running from them, his hiding, was because his life was being sought. But as soon as he was taken, then that was also the Lord's will, and the Lord would protect him. There was an instance in Texas in 04 that I remember real well. One of my cousins was on gate watch down there at the ranch, and my father came in and stopped at the gatehouse and told him, hired assassins followed me to the gate. So he told us stories like that, and we thought it was real.
Oh, wow. Do you think he was just trying to scare you?
Well, there's absolutely no proof that that's true. He just,
I see,
maybe felt like God showed him that.
So how old were you when you got taken to the ranch? You said 13?
I got taken to the ranch when I was 14 years old in July of 2004, and it originally had to do with my mother. She was battling breast cancer.
Oh man!
She had had her younger children, separated from her and taken away for months without any contact or knowing where they were. And eventually he brought her there shortly before she died. So he saw that she was about to die. They had to take her into the hospital because she had pneumonia. And he brought me and my two older sisters that were married down to Texas to the hospital to see her before she died. And then he was going to have me go back to Short Creek.
Man, I'm sorry to hear that. I didn't realize your mom had passed.
Yes, she did. He allowed me to come to the ranch after he sent me back to Short Creek. When I was on my way back, then he called and had me and my sister Rachel return to Texas and come to the ranch. And that's where my life on the ranch actually started.
I see.
So was your mother ever able to reconnect with those younger children before passing?
Yes. He brought two of them to Short Creek for a short time before he took her. And then she was really sick, but she was able to connect with them shortly before she passed. She was there for about 1 month.
This is kind of a side note, but I know a lot of people are going to wonder this, so I feel that I need to ask. Did your mother get proper care for, like, cancer treatment for what she was battling?
She noticed something was wrong for a year or so before she was allowed to go check it, and he didn't allow her to go get checked up on it. When he finally said she could go see it, she was already so far that they gave her about 6 months to live.
Oh my gosh.
And her story is really sad because she didn't like chemo. She went through it once and it made her really sick. And so she went looking for a natural cure and got into a few things that she felt like would help her get better. And then my father came back to her and said, "The Lord says you didn't pass the test the first time you went through chemo, so you have to go through chemo again."
Oh, sheesh. So made it seem like it was her own fault, that she didn't suffer enough, that she needed to suffer more.
Yes, and it actually made her really sick and really destroyed her immune system to go through that twice.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
I found years and years later, this last year, in his writings where he said he had prayed for her to get sick and die because he felt like she wouldn't pass the tests.
What?
That he was going to have him go through later on.
So, oh my gosh, I'm just so sorry. I don't even know where to begin with that. So because he thought that she was too weak to be among the strong people of Zion, better to just fail early on, basically, before the tests really get hard.
Yeah, I think she had quite a strong determination and wasn't afraid to speak her mind if she felt like something was wrong. And I believe he felt threatened by that.
Oh my gosh. I'm sorry.
Man. So after your mother passing and you get sent to the ranch, and that's kind of where your journey on the ranch begins, right? Is that what you said?
Yes.
What did that look like for a 14-year-old boy? What did your life on the ranch look like?
Okay, so my life changed dramatically when I went there. I was put on the work crew right away after listening to hours and hours of trainings that Father had given. And the work schedule was extreme. When I arrived, we were supposed to work till 2 in the morning and then be up by 5 in the morning the next day.
What was the purpose for that? The extreme work schedule, you think?
He claimed that the reason he started the places, what he called places of refuge, was because the saints in Short Creek were going to be scattered, driven, and killed. And we had to have places ready for them to come to if they were worthy. That was the purpose he gave to us of having those. And he put us on very tight time schedules constantly.
It's crazy because when we've heard this, like there are some other men that we've talked to that were on the ranch. And every time someone says this, it still is just so not hard to believe you, because we totally believe all of you. But it's just, it feels like something out of a movie that is like unbelievable, the type of like mental and physical torture that would be to get such little sleep. Like that's what they do to like prisoner of wars, you know, camps and stuff, to be in constant sleep deprivation, and the mental and physical exhaustion is literally a form of torture.
Well, and it's a way to put people in a position where they're easily controlled. And so I have to wonder if maybe that was a part of it, is if your lack of sleep and your lack of food would make it so much easier to control these people and to trick them into believing certain things. Yet, do you think there's any truth to that, or is that just speculation?
Well, you're constantly tired. I can tell you, never, ever feel like you're going to ever get enough sleep or ever even know what it's like to not be tired and exhausted. And it's not like you can get more done if you work 20 hours a day.
Right. Mm-mm. Yeah, I agree.
It's just you are constantly working and you're constantly tired. So you don't really have time to think about everything else. And if you miss his time schedules, you are rebuked by the Lord, according to him. And he had to actually go through this suffering for you, or else he would claim the Lord is about to destroy us on those lands.
So tell me if I misunderstand this. So if you do something wrong, he basically is claiming that he needs to be a savior and atone for your sins.
Absolutely correct. Almost in those very words.
Oh my gosh.
So what would he say about Jesus Christ himself? Because the idea that there needs to be a second savior is pretty sacrilegious on its own.
Yeah.
So he claimed that Jesus suffered the most, but the prophets suffer in their capacity like Jesus for their peoples. And he claims all the other men that were prophets suffered like he did. And as a young person, I wondered, if that's true, how come all the other prophets didn't tell us about it and only he does?
Yeah, they suffered much more quietly and humbly, right?
Wow. But I mean, it's one thing to suffer because of persecution, or, you know, to prove yourself self-worthy or whatever you might say that some of the other prophets of old did. But it's a whole other thing when you're claiming you're doing it to atone for the sins of your people. That is where it seems like he's claiming to be a savior or another Jesus Christ in a way. And that just seems so beyond anything I've ever heard before.
Yes, he claimed it was a spiritual suffering, and it was way more intense than anything we could ever possibly understand. And he claims to often be going through it, even to this day. That's a big part of what a lot of people that believe in him still think he's doing.
Oh, in prison.
Yes, the term the prophet suffering for us goes beyond him just being locked in a prison cell. It's actually meaning this atonement or spiritual suffering like Jesus.
This might be an insult to you, but I have to ask, just so the people out there can know your answer, do you feel that he ever did suffer like he claims he did?
No, I don't think he suffered for our sins.
Okay. Just want to make sure, because you never know what kind of what kind of show maybe he put on to make it seem realistic or something.
Right. And he mostly claimed it was at times that we didn't see, but a few times he did it in front of us. And as a young person, it was scary to me.
Hmm. What did that look like, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah, and that there'll be a story in the book, but there was a time in meeting where he corrected us very strongly and sent away certain leading men from the group that was there. And after a couple hour meeting, then he said a really long prayer. And as he was saying the prayer, he went into these groaning and moaning and acting like he could hardly speak. And then when he said amen, he collapsed onto the floor in front of everyone.
That must have been terrifying as a kid watching your father go through that.
Yeah.
I thought he was dying as a 14-year-old. I didn't know what was going on.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, you're taught that he's not only, you know, a man of God, but the prophet speaking for God. And so I can only imagine at that age, you wouldn't in a million years assume that he was just putting on a big act, right?
Right. I didn't think so at the time.
Well, without getting into too many details of the raid, because I'm excited to read the book for all the nitty-gritty little things, do you want to give us a quick overview of what the raid felt like, kind of how old you were, and just a quick overview of that process of being a part of that as a child?
So in 2008, when I was still 17, so I turned 18 later in the raid, we didn't really think anything big was coming. Father had said greater persecution's about to come upon the people. At one point, he said it's possible government officials will even try to come interview and things will get pretty rough. But nothing really seen in the air until suddenly one day we're told there's cops out at the gate. Hmm. And whenever a government agency came on the land, he had everyone go in their houses. So they wouldn't see how many people were there because he felt like we were always under threat. So we didn't really know what was going on. And I went and climbed up on top of the grain elevator and saw that there was hundreds of cop cars out on the main county road and blocking any access point to the ranch. So I was really surprised and I didn't have a clue what they were after. And I, at the time, didn't think it was going to turn into a raid. Then, when they came in, they just came in to interview some of the girls at first. So we really didn't realize this was a big, huge thing that was about to take place.
I see. So what was your first, I mean, because it's one thing if you see a couple cop cars outside your gates, but when you see hundreds, what was your first thought? Was your first thought that, oh, they're going to completely take us out of here and destroy our ranch? Or what were your thoughts?
I didn't know what to think. I wondered what was so big going on at the ranch that would require that much law enforcement to come and to block mm-hmm. us off. And there were men that immediately went out to the gate to talk to them, but we didn't know what was going on, and they didn't tell us. Right. We just knew there were men out to the gate talking to them, Uncle Merrill, who was the bishop, and a few others. And that's all we knew. And they were staying outside. They weren't rushing in. So obviously they weren't coming to kill us. At least I never thought that.
That's good. But still, it must have been terrifying. So they come in and they want to talk to a couple of the girls. I believe, if I know how the story goes, they got some kind of information from an anonymous source, or maybe not so anonymous, that there was some abuse going on, or that there were girls in there that didn't want to be in there. Were they coming in to find said girls, or do you know?
Yeah, the original story was that a woman named Sarah Jessup Barlow was calling because she was being abused by her husband, Dale Barlow. And there wasn't anybody there named either of those names. And we didn't learn until after we were all taken into custody that this is actually a woman in Colorado calling and just making false allegations. So that's what the origins of the raid were based off of.
At what point did you know that, like, after they're doing the interviews on some of the girls, at what point did they start interviewing the boys, or were you taken off of the ranch before they started doing the interviews on the boys? Like, at what point did you know, okay, we're going somewhere and we're being taken to go do these things?
The day after the raid started, they came on the land at about 9 in the evening and started interviewing girls from the ranch that were between 8 and 17 years old. They interviewed them all night and started to detain them, where they wouldn't allow anyone to talk to them, wouldn't allow them to leave the school. And the next morning, they started to search other places on the ranch for the supposed Sarah. But it wasn't until late that afternoon that they started to gather up all the children. And they did not interview anyone in my family before they took us off the ranch. They just came in and removed us.
So something must have happened to go from, let's find so-and-so, this Sarah girl, to, all right, you're all coming with us. You know, what do you think triggered that?
Well, I stayed up all night the night before, and I saw CPS go to the high school girls' classroom and go through their journals. And I believe they found some writing. Perhaps some of the girls talked and realized there were underage mothers, girls who had married underage on the ranch. And so they started looking around more and felt like there was a danger. Also, the children gave varying degrees of information to them, and a lot of children wouldn't give any information. And the reason for that would be similar to your fear as growing up of another raid, like the 53 raid, where as soon as we saw they were serious, we felt like for our own protection, we didn't want to give them information because we felt like it was all to be used against us just so they could take us away.
Right. And that's what we were taught. And I assume even more extremely, you were taught that way on the ranch too.
Yes, there was a buildup of fear of government oppression.
Yeah. So they come in and they ultimately take everyone off of the ranch, or at least all of the children. And what did that look like? I mean, did the children go willingly? What was the situation when that happened?
When they took our family, they told us we'd possibly be back that night or the next morning, and they just needed to interview us in El Dorado away from the ranch. So we didn't think it was going to be very long, and we didn't realize there was an intent to put us in custody. We had no idea how custody laws worked. warehouse CPS rules and their procedures worked at all, or we probably would have approached the whole thing differently.
And when they take you off, you think it's going to be a short time. And at what point do you realize we're going to be here longer? And how many children were there total at that point as well that had been taken off with you?
I was taken to the El Dorado Civic Center, and we had 120 or 150 people in one building, one room. And we still thought we were going to go back, and they removed us from there to Fort Concho in San Angelo. And when they finally got through with their search on the ranch and still didn't let us go back, that's when we realized we were in for a longer. We didn't know how long, but we knew we'd be in there longer, because as the search continued, we thought, and they intimated, we're just waiting for the search to be over. We can't let you go back until the search is over. But the search was over after about a week, and then nothing changed.
Did they communicate with you, like, through the process of, you know, oh, it might be longer, or this is going to be the next step? Was there a lot of communication, or were you just in fear of the unknown the whole time you were there?
We were in fear of the unknown, and it felt like there was quite a rift, a lot of friction between us and CPS. It felt like CPS was quite coarse with us. And I'm not saying everybody in CPS was, but enough of the people in charge that we felt like they were trying to get information from us so they could keep us for any reason. And I don't know their side of the story, because I'm not one of them, but that's how we felt. And we felt like they lied to us a lot, and we were very afraid they were going to separate the children from the mothers. We thought the more info we gave them, the more excuses they would find to try to separate the children from the mothers. And that made us be quite clammed up on information. And the third reason why we wouldn't give information was because Father had taught, if you give information about him, about the church, then you're turning traitor to the priesthood, which is the greatest sin you can commit.
Right. That would turn you into a son of perdition or something along those lines, where you would go to the worst place if you turn against God and his church.
You're right. And he got that to the point that just giving information about him or what he did and had going on those lands was turning traitor. When you went on those lands, you made a covenant to not reveal the teachings he was giving to anybody not there. Not even in the church. So if you got sent away to Short Creek or among the other people that weren't on the land, you could not talk to them about what you were doing there or what he taught in his trainings.
Hmm.
Wow.
I noticed that, because when some of my family members disappeared, and I know now they were at the ranch and then they came back, they didn't say a single word. It was all so, so secretive. So I was always very curious what was going on.
Yes, if they had told, they would have never been allowed back. And they wanted to, because that was a special place to be. That was, in our minds, the redemption of Zion happening.
Wow.
Did the rest of you that are on the work crews, obviously there's a lot of people there at the ranch. How many people do you think actually knew about the abuse that was really going on?
I think that it was restricted to just a small group around my father that actually knew what he was doing in secret with the young girls that he would take as his wives. And it was known that he married the other young girls off to other men. Mm-hmm. But of course, he portrayed that as God chooses when people should get married. And I'm just doing what he says. I'm not doing anything on my own. I just... and being perfectly obedient. And of course, as a young boy, I watched my own classmates get married to Father, and I wondered why it was so young, and how would I get to marry somebody anywhere near my age if he was marrying the girls off so young? Because that's really what started to happen there.
Well, and we've seen with that issue there, and a lot of people have asked, well, you know, if they are marrying these girls at such a young age and so many of these girls to one man, how is there going to be enough girls for all of the other men? That's a big question, yeah. Right? a lot of the men now we know are just kicked out, and they for very almost awful excuses were just kicked out of the community, at least based on the stories that I've seen and heard. So I think you had a valid concern there.
Do you feel like there were more underage marriages happening on the ranch than what there had been like in the Sandy area or in Short Creek? Do you feel like it increased on the ranch?
Yes. When we were in Sandy, then it wasn't really a problem. And it didn't seem to become a big issue until after my grandfather had a stroke and father basically took over the church. That's when I noticed the marriage age come way down. Because the first several of my mother's, the women that married my father, were in their 20s. At the ranch, there were no girls over 15 years old that weren't married when he was there, before he went to prison. After he went to prison, then there were.
So were you aware, because at least rumor has it now, I haven't met every one of them or know personally, but I've heard from multiple sources that your father ended up with about 80 wives. Is that accurate? And if it is accurate, did you know that there were that many wives involved when you were still a part of it all?
Yes. We knew who all the ladies were that father had married.
Okay.
I never really kept count. People are way better at keeping track of it than I was. But you're right. There was about 78 or 79.
Okay.
And out of that number, only 17, I believe, actually had children by him.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Why do you think he married so many other girls or young women?
Good question. I think it's a moral problem.
Okay. That's what I assumed, but it's interesting that I don't know. I'm grateful that he only had children with that many instead of with all of them, but it's so hard for me to try to understand where he was coming from and why he was doing what he was doing. So there's probably not an answer to it.
Yeah, I haven't had one. There were some of the ladies that seemed to just be the servants of everyone, and others that had the children, and others that got to be used and be part of his special group.
Oh, man. So after you've been taken, being a part of the raid, about how long was it before you were reunited with your family? And did you just go back on the ranch, or where did you go from there?
We were gone for about 60 days. I was separated from my family at 10 days and then taken with a group of teenage boys up to Calfardi's Boys Ranch in North Texas in the Panhandle. And later they brought another busload of 27, and after that, a busload of 18 boys there. So we had 72 boys at Boys Ranch.
Wow. And what did they tell you was the reason for taking you up there or separating you from your family?
They would just tell us it's in the best interest of the shelters that we remove you from your family. And then when they took us to Boys Ranch, a CPS person came into our shelter at Fort Concho and read a paper to us that said they're going to move everyone from Fort Concho to one facility where we could be reunited with our families. Then they got us on the bus and were ready to pull out. And a CPS man got up on the bus and said, we're going for 6 or 7 hours of travel, and you guys are going to Boys Ranch up by Amarillo. So we were lied to and very shocked that this happened. We were not happy.
So frustrating.
Did you feel that you had any, I mean, at that young age, you probably felt completely helpless. Did anybody try to fight back and say, no, I want to go to my family? Or was it just, well, we're trapped here?
We were on a bus with cops all around and cops on the bus. And the CPS man on our bus had formerly been police officers, so they were ready for us to fight, and I could tell. So all the boys looked up to me like, what should we do? And I just turned around and said, let's just be peaceful about this, because there wasn't really anything else we could do without getting in a lot of trouble. And right. Some of the boys wanted to push the windows open and jump out and try running, but we didn't.
Right.
And gratefully, later on the ride up to Boys Ranch, one of the CPS workers was nudged his buddy and said, "Hey, can you tell what that is up there on the shelf?" And I was watching, and they were laughing, and the other guy said, "Yeah, I can tell what that is." And so I looked at it, and it was zip tie handcuffs. So they were ready for us to fight, and I'm really glad we didn't get into a row over it.
Okay.
Wow. So you're there, you're in custody for 60 days. What did it look like for you being reunited with family? Was it your, I mean, at that point, your mother had passed, who came, and your father's in prison. So who was able to come for you?
My mother's sister, Annette, who is father's first wife, was a guardian for my mother's children. So okay. We had been under her care, and to us it was a big reunification with all our siblings because we were scattered all over the place. We were separate from our own mother's children or several of our own mother's children. So siblings were not kept together. Mm-hmm. I had two of my mother's boys with me, but my two younger sisters were both in separate places from each other and us.
Oh, man.
And we had no communication with each other.
Oh, it's so frustrating. Man. I mean, even CPS, we've had a CPS worker on our channel before, and she actually left after a week because she said the experience was so horrific being on that side, and she thought it was handled so poorly. She literally tossed her hands in the air and said, "I'm going back. I can't be a part of this." So it just breaks my heart every time we talk about it because both sides will admit how poorly things were handled.
Yeah, it was not handled correctly at all. And so.
Right. And that's what we felt like.
Yeah. I'm sorry you went through all that. I can't even imagine. I mean, in 60 days is a long time.
That would have felt like a year. If you don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
It would have felt like forever.
I mean, if something traumatic is happening in your life, one day can seem like a year. I mean, 60 days is a long, long time. Were they constantly promising, "Hey, we'll get you back to your family," or were you just kind out of luck?
Once they had the 14-day hearing, is what they called it, and Judge Walther ruled that we could not be returned home, our attorneys told us it could be 6 months. And when they told us that, I thought we were going to die if it lasts for this long. A boys' ranch, us older boys took care of the younger boys the whole time, tried to fill their parents' shoes. And we had a lot of responsibility we'd never had before. So for us, it was a huge growing up experience, trying to watch out for the young boys, our siblings. And I had 16 brothers there out of my father's own family.
Wow, I can't even imagine. And then you get picked up. Do you go back to the ranch or did you go back to Short Creek?
Some of the families went back to the ranch, but a lot of the families had found rental homes in San Antonio and Dallas and other areas because CPS had told them if they did that, they were more likely to get their children back sooner. So we actually didn't move back to the ranch for about a year. We would go visit there. But we had to check in with CPS before we went there.
I see. So ultimately, did you end up back on the ranch after all that?
Yes, I moved back there in May of 2009 from San Antonio and got back to work.
Wow.
My goodness. Well, all the details, we don't want to get into everything because there's a lot to cover in your book. And, you know, maybe after a while we can have you back on to explain some of the things throughout your book or something. But we do want to get a little bit of information about kind of where you are today. You know, you go through this really traumatic experience. How in the world did you go from that to ultimately leaving that belief system, right? Like, that's quite the step to take.
Yes. And when we got out of the raid, we felt galvanized in our faith. Father predicted persecution came, and it was proof to us that we were right and everybody else was wrong. So we were quite strengthened by the raid, but as the years started to progress, he became very strict and stringent with his rules. He started to correct people for things they didn't do, and a lot of us in his own family went through that. Time after time, where we were corrected, sent away, made a non-member, and then allowed back and baptized again, and sent away. I even was sent away from Short Creek to go far away, like other men have been sent away from their families, and went and lived in Minnesota for almost a year before he let me come back. So a lot of that stuff made me start wondering if he really was being led by God, especially when I saw visible proof that it wasn't true. His prophecies weren't happening, and he was claiming things happened that absolutely didn't happen. So I began to question that, and as I dug deeper, I began to feel like he's not being led by God right now for whatever reason. And yeah, I still had ingrained into me that the FLDS church is the only true church of God on the earth. So I didn't want to leave it for that purpose. And I got to the point where I disregarded what he said because it was so bizarre.
Did it get more bizarre, or were you just realizing how bizarre it's always been?
Well, it's got worse and worse from, I was especially say 2011 till today, to the point where to believe the revelations and messages he sends out is to deny absolute facts that are right in front of your eyes. And as I saw that take place, as I saw him claim things like Donald Trump has given him a pardon, or all the wicked are being lifted off the earth, and there's only a few million left, I could see that wasn't true. Then the ultimate straw that broke the camel's back was one of my sisters that is in the church still admitting to me that my father had molested her as a child. And at that point, I knew there's no way he spoke for God.
Wow. That must have shattered your world. I cannot even imagine to think of all the years you spent thinking that he was this perfect person, and then to hear something like that from your own sister. And then since then, I'm sure you've heard a lot more of what, I mean, how do you cope with that?
Yes, that absolutely shattered it. And I felt like I had fought for him, stood up for him, defended him, especially through the raid. And to find out everything that the people out of the church claimed about him, when I found out they claimed his crimes were true and knew they were true, then I was completely shocked. And we had been very sheltered from hearing anything that anyone that left claimed he did. For instance, my sister Rachel, we weren't even allowed to know what she said, and were told if we wondered why she left, then we were in the wrong for even wondering, because it was just because she was a bad person and immoral. That was the reason he gave us.
She was the one that was immoral, huh? That was the way it was put?
Yes, that's what he claimed. And yet, my other sister I mentioned finally tells me it actually is true what happened. Then I was completely shocked.
Wow.
I'm so sorry. That's...
Yeah. Have you read your sister Rachel's book at this point?
Yes, I have. I've read her book, and I have a lot of contact with her to this day. Good. And good. I'm really glad we could reconnect.
Good.
Rachel's from the same mother as I am.
Oh, really?
Oh, wow.
Wow. That's amazing. And I'm so happy that you've been able to come this far. I mean, the strength that it must take. I mean, people tell me that, you know, what a strong person you must be. And I'm like, compared to the other stuff people went through, I was living in bliss, you know, compared to the other stories that
ignorant
I hear.
Ignorant bliss.
Yeah, ignorant bliss, seriously. And to the point where I just ultimately chose, yeah, I want a different lifestyle. But I didn't deal with some of the craziness. I mean, yes, it was very unique, and there were some very difficult things that I had to deal with that came along with, you know, leaving my family behind and having to cut them off because of a different belief and all that. So very difficult, but compared to what you've done and the strength that would have taken, my hat goes off to you.
Well, thank you. The hardest part, like you said, is the shunning of your family, and or being shunned by your family. That's always really difficult. Mm-hmm. But at this point, yeah, too, if you want to experience what it means to be in hell or to be damned, then that is the condition the FLDS are in. And the condition you feel like you're in the FLDS church, you literally feel like you're stuck in a rut and you're spinning and you're spinning and you're spinning and you can't get out. Hmm.
That is how people define hell. Just for our viewers, how long have you been out? How long ago did you officially leave the FLDS church?
Mentally and physically out. I left about the 1st of June, 2023. So it hasn't quite been a year.
Wow. That's so recent.
Did you have a lot of family that had already left? Did you have a support system that you were able to go to? Or what did that look like when you did choose to leave physically?
Yes. A lot of my sisters and brothers had left. And when I left, I believe I was the 26th. Of my father's children had left, which is half of us.
Oh, wow.
So there was a good support system, which I'm very thankful for. Family, friends, and relatives that were there to help me. The hardest part is generally the first month where you're just peeling an onion, trying to sort everything out, make sense of life and truth and error. Hmm. And it's really difficult, a terrible mental strain.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I can speak for that as well. It's very, very challenging to come from knowing everything that you know between right and wrong, or at least thinking that you know everything, you have all the answers, and then all of a sudden you know nothing. You have to basically start from the beginning and try to figure out what life is all about, and it can be a big challenge.
Yeah, it feels like you're starting over, for sure.
Yeah. If there was, we try to ask a lot of our people that we interview this question, but if there was somebody that is still under the direction of your father right now that happened to be watching, what would you want to say to them?
I'd want them to know I haven't regretted leaving for one moment, and it is okay to be happy, and you can be a good and happy person out here and thrive. There are good people out here. And you can make good life choices. And there's no reason to be afraid that you'll become a wicked person just because Warren Jeffs or other followers of Warren Jeffs say you will be.
Yeah. I love that.
It's a very good way to put it. So yeah. Amen to that. And thank you so much for coming on here today and sharing a little bit of your story. Everyone, go check out Texas Raid from Ammon Jeffs, his book. I can't wait to read it. It's going to have a lot more detail here. And like I said, if you're up to it, Ammon, maybe we can have you on again later down the road and get into some of the other questions people might have about the information in the book. So thank you once again for being here with us today, Ammon.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. And yes, that would be fun to do if we end up doing it.
Yes, we will put the link to Ammon's book below. Please, if you want to hear more from amazing, courageous people like Ammon that are willing to leave such tough situations and hear more about what it was like for him to grow up in polygamy, for Sam to grow up in polygamy, then please like and subscribe.
Yes, thank you all so much for being here with us again today. We look forward to talking with you soon.
Talk to y'all soon.